Side 12, Eon by Greg Baer, continuing on page 469. You have about half an hour, Olmi said, his voice conveyed from the monitor to her torque. After that, the radiation from the plasma front will be dangerously intense. Will that be time enough?
I think so. I hope so.
Patricia checked her bag and found everything in place. Multimeter, processor, slates, and blocks. She held the clavicle before her, searching. For 10 minutes, she walked back and forth, north and south, the clavicle conveying the enormous stretches of alternate worlds she crossed with each step. She discarded impressions from nearly all of them, trying not to jam her senses. Within another 10 minutes, she had located a line several centimeters long that seemed to harbor the point she was searching for. She kneeled, the traction bubble comfortably flexible beneath her. The clavicle guided itself within this tiny space, her hands merely completing the causal connection. In 5 more minutes, she had the search down to fractions of a millimeter. The information from each separate universe was much more complex now. She was indeed close to an alternate Earth, and the time period was approximately correct, within a few years. Hurry, Olmi said. The plasma front is near. It was very difficult. Her theories proved to be not quite as precise as she had hoped. Within even the smallest segments of the geometry stack, worlds of substantial degrees of difference interwove. She could see now why Kozhinovsky and his followers had initially regarded the regions of geometry stacking as useless. The clavicle stopped. She could not tell if she was tuning the region finely enough, but she could spend days searching and not be any closer. She closed her eyes and gave it one final tweak. I'm ready, she said. Then do it, Lanier said. She looked back at the partial and smiled her gratitude.
Thank you for everything.
Lanier nodded. You're most welcome. It's been fascinating.
Yes, hasn't it?
She began the gate dilation. To the north, the corridor was filling with a reddish glow. As the seconds passed, the glow progressed higher through the spectrum. Orange, an awesome greenish blue. The clavicle's whistle was painfully intense. She saw a circle of whirling possibilities at her feet, and then she saw the circle, little more than a meter wide, clarify, presenting a distorted picture of blue skies, something bright tan, large shapes and water. She did not have the precise location. She would be on land, she could sense that much, but had no idea where on earth that land would be. Wherever, the traction field would protect her. Lanier's partial bent through her traction field to give her a parting kiss. His lips felt pliant, warm. Go! Olmi commanded. She stepped through the gate. It was like sliding down a hill. Everything twisted and spilled around her. She released the clavicle and then grabbed it again with one hand. There was the sound of water, something huge and sharp and white not far away, blinding sun. Lanier and Olmi faced the oncoming radiation. It's not like dying, Lanier thought. There's another complete me escaping even now. But he will never experience these things. I'll never report to him. They were surrounded by an intense brightness that went beyond light or heat. Olmi grimaced and grinned at once, relishing the sensation. He had sent partials to die before and had never known what their sensations were like. Now he would experience it directly, and the original Olmi would still never know. The monitors will last a fraction of a second in the plasma front itself, he explained to Lanier. We'll spend the briefest moment inside a star. Lanier, without pain, without much fear, faced directly north and looked into the heart of the furnace rushing down on them at 6,000 kilometers per second. There was not even time to savor the sensation. On the floor ship, perilously close to the ravening plasma, Lanier closed his eyes and told himself again and again that he had carried out his responsibilities and accompanied his charge to the very last. Still clutching the clavicle, bag strapped to her shoulder, Patricia fell from an altitude of 5 or 6 meters into water. She was not even wet. She lay in the bottom of the floating traction bubble, stunned. The water, a river or canal, carried her several dozen meters from the gate. She looked to one side to see where she was. That was just as well. An intense blue-white plume flowed from the gate and blasted the water behind into steam, covering everything with a thick white cloud. Fortunately for her, and for everything within a few hundred meters, the gate was fused permanently shut within millionths of a second. She lay back in the bubble, partly blinded, with one hand over her eyes, and drifted for several more minutes until she grounded against a sandbar. Her sight had recovered well enough by then. Standing, she surveyed the territory, heart pounding. She was on the shore of a broad, straight canal, the sluggish water a deep, muddy brown. The bank was lined with tall green reeds. The sky was an intense pale blue, cloudless, and the sun was very bright. With some qualms, she shut off the traction bubble and took a deep breath. The air was sweet, clean, and warm. She was heavier than she had been since leaving Timbal. This time she had no floater belt to buoy her up. The gravity was uncomfortable. But this was undeniably Earth, and she was not in a nuclear wasteland. In fact, the scenery was hauntingly familiar. She had seen it all before, in the Bible classes Rita had insisted she take as a child. Shading her eyes, Patricia looked to the west. Across the canal and on a plateau were brilliant plaster-white pyramids, kilometers away but sharp in the clear desert air. She felt a moment of excitement. It was Egypt. She could travel from Egypt. That would be a minor problem. She could get home from here. She turned around. On a rickety-looking scaffold emerging from the reeds stood a small, slender brown girl, no more than 10 or 11, naked except for a white cloth tied around her hips. Her hair was done up in many long, close-knotted braids, each tipped with a blue stone. The girl regarded Patricia with slack-jawed wonder mixed with fear. "Hello," Patricia called, trudging up the sandy bank. "Do you speak English? Can you tell me where I am?" The girl turned deftly on the scaffold and fled. For a horrible moment, Patricia wondered if she had slipped several millennia in time, if in fact she was in ancient Egypt. Then she heard a distant rumble and looked up. Her relief was so great she almost whooped. There was an airplane, probably a jet, flying high above the desert. Walking along the edge of the canal, clutching her clavicle and considering whether or not to reactivate the traction bubble, the sun was becoming uncomfortably hot. Patricia found a road and followed it. Beyond a grove of date palms, she came upon a little square town made of whitewashed brick, the houses as blocky as benches and about as uniform. Very few people were about. It was just past high noon, and no doubt they were all resting until the day cooled. Something bothered her. She hadn't thought about it before, but now that she remembered, putting the clavicle down on the stone roadbed, shading her eyes with both hands, she looked west again. From this vantage, she could see that the pyramids were surrounded by thick groves of trees. She couldn't tell what kind. That didn't seem right. Weren't the Egyptian pyramids in desert? And how many large pyramids had there been on Earth? 3? She counted 8 smooth-surfaced white pyramids in a row, filing off to the horizon. "Wrong-o," she said softly to herself. Chapter 65 Lanier floated in the flagship's prow, alone and content to stay that way for a long time. Kilometer after thousands of incommensurable kilometers flowed by, black and gold and indistinct. What it had all come down to was that he owed more to Earth than he did to Patricia, and he could not help her complete her journey, see her through safely, because it was not his journey to make. Did she survive? Reach her destination? Even if she did, in this half-dream, half-nightmare way of stacked universes, she was as far from him and as inaccessible as if she had died. Olmi tracked it behind him, clearing his throat. "I'm fine," Lanier said testily. "That was never at question," Olmi said. "I thought you might wish to know our situation. We're well ahead of the plasma front. The radiation is tolerable, though I'd suggest a thorough physical Talcid session when we arrive." "What about the precincts?" "We've communicated with them. As we suspected, they are accelerating toward us now. They've agreed to lift their grips and let us pass through them.
Can we do that?
With some luck, yes, Olney said. They'll be at 31% light speed.
I suppose that will be something to see, Lanier said.
I doubt we'll see much of anything, Olney said.
Figure of speech.
Yes. There's food available if you wish it. Sir Yates is equipped to eat and would enjoy your company.
How long until we meet the precincts?
27 minutes, Olney said.
Lanier swallowed hard and rotated. Sure, he said. I could eat. He ate very little, however, glancing nervously about the cabin, at the non-humans, secluded in their traction bubbles, dormant or disturbingly active. The snake with four heads was doing a quick, jerky ballet in its greenish fluid. At Precient Oyu, who frankly returned his look, at Yates as he ate, the most human-seeming of them all, the most natural in his habits, and yet an opener of gates. Olney was quiet and still. Not far from him, the worker that held Kozhinovsky's reconstructed personality, and part of Patricia as well, floated wrapped in traction lines, its image shut off as it continued the long process of final maturation. Lanier put aside the rest of his uneaten meal and said he would rather wait at the bow. Olney agreed. They crowded forward, Lanier beside Olney and Yates, with the odd U-shaped beast on the opposite side of the floor passage, still surrounded by its quarantine field. The two Frants relaxed behind them all, curled up with only necks and heads extended. Ahead, the black and gold became a warmer orange and brown. The floor pulsed faintly pink, disturbed by their acceleration. Just a few seconds, Olney said. The way appeared to balloon outward in all directions. Lanier felt his hands tingle and his eyes grow warm. The floor vibrated and glowed to a searing blue. The transparent bow grew darker and darker to compensate. The floor passage through the middle of the ship vibrated and groaned. Just a few seconds of life. Less. Lanier felt as if he were exploding. He yelled in pain and surprise and flung out his arms and legs. Then it was over. He drifted against a net of traction lines, blinking. The way was black and gold again. The floor glowed faintly pink. "There's no damage," Olney said. "Correction," Yates said, holding a hand over his eye. Lanier had struck him with an elbow. He apologized.
"Nothing to be upset over," Yates said. "All the more excuse for some Tauset. Quite exciting, actually." Behind them, accelerating at 400 Gs, the linked Axis Nadir and Central City met the plasma front with their building shockwave of space-time, beginning the process of converting the way into an elongated nova. The radiation level outside the floorship increased sharply. The charges around the perimeter of the seventh chamber were set. Engineers had gone throughout the Thistledown, making final structural checks and testing the sixth chamber machinery. When the asteroid was blown from the beginning of the way, the sixth chamber machinery would face an enormous strain, the end of its duties as stabilizer of the way, and a sudden and violent increase in its policing of destructive forces inside the chambers. The precincts of Axes, Thoreau, and Euclid had been moved north 100,000 kilometers from the seventh chamber. Within the twin cylinders, the confusion was enormous. Most of the Axis citizens, the Naderites, Orthodox and otherwise, and a surprising number of Homorph Geshels, had been reassigned to new quarters. Few were completely familiar with their new precincts. There was a sense of holiday, of triumph, and also a heavy air of anxiety. By the hundreds, the Earth people filled the processing halls, tended by Geshel doctors and watched over by advocates. A male homorph, Hoffman noted the word and added it to her rapidly growing vocabulary, took skin samples from his group of 20 Earth people. She was seventh in line. For each, he had a smile and a few well-chosen words of encouragement. He was handsome, but not to her taste, a little too finely honed, his characteristics not noticeably different from those of a dozen other homorphs. Or perhaps her senses weren't sophisticated. She was used to the broad varieties of physiognomy from her time, when unavoidable defects, misshapen noses, corpulence, dental misalignments, produced a medieval carnival of features. When the samples had been stored, he produced a face-shaped cup from his floating toolbox. "This performs a number of medical analyses," he told them. "These tests are also voluntary, but your cooperation will be most helpful." They all cooperated, peering into the cup and watching a series of complex patterns for several seconds. Throughout the proceedings, she felt a sense not of coming misery or servitude, but of camaraderie. So many of the attendants proudly flew projected flags over their left shoulders, flags of India, Australia, China, the United States, Japan, the USSR, and other nations. All were willing, eager even, to speak to their charges in native tongues. When the medical exams were completed, they were led off to a series of elevators opening on one side of the hall. Anne Blakely, Lanier's secretary, and now Hoffman's, crossed over from another group. With her was Doreen Cunningham, former head of security in the science compound. "Everybody's so tense," Cunningham whispered to Hoffman. "Not me," Hoffman said. "I feel like I'm on some kind of holiday. The big folks are taking over now." "Oh, Lord." She had just peered into their elevator. It didn't have any floor. Even with explanations and a demonstration from the attendants, it took some coaxing to get them to move forward. They hung on to each other as a group of 60 ascended. Cunningham kept her eyes closed. Most of the Russians were resigned to the worst, she told Hoffman. Their gloomy pessimism kept them pretty much to themselves. "Somebody told me a few of our people have defected," Hoffman said, keeping her eyes resolutely on the back of the person in front of her. The elevator walls were too uniform to show motion, and there was no sensation, unpleasant or otherwise, but she still wasn't enjoying the trip. "Four. Two Russians and two Americans. That's what I've heard," Anne said. "Anybody know who?" "Rimskaya," Cunningham said. "And Beryl Wallace." "Beryl?" She raised her eyebrows and shook her head. "I wouldn't expect that from her, or Rimskaya." Did she feel they had betrayed her? That was ridiculous. "What about the Russians?" "One of them is Mirsky," Anne said. "I didn't recognize the second name." Mirsky didn't surprise her at all. She could read strangers clearly, but not the people in her own command. So much for the instincts of a master administrator. Their quarters were spread through the precincts. More homorphs met them as the groups were further divided and escorted to apartments on different levels. "You'll be sharing quarters in parties of three," their escort told them. "Space is at a premium now." "Roomies?" Cunningham asked Hoffman and Blakely. "Roomies," Hoffman said. Blakely nodded. The group of 12 dwindled rapidly as attendants shunted them into vacant quarters. They were the last three, escorted by a single female homorph, who picked at a Russian flag over her shoulder. Their apartment was at the very end of a long, gently curved cylindrical hallway. Green numbers beneath the door glowed brightly as they approached. The rooms were small and very blank. The homorph remained to give them basic instructions on use of the data services. She then wished them well and departed. "Such a hurry," Blakely said, shaking her head. "Since we're out of the action," Hoffman said, "or along for the ride, whatever, we might as well settle in." Within minutes, they were eagerly discussing the possibilities of decor with an assigned ghost from the library. They had several hours before the breakout, as it was being called. Hoffman used that time to contact others in the precinct who had been assigned quarters. Blakely and Cunningham decided on an interim decor, which gave some color and shape, and considerably more apparent living space, to the apartment. Hoffman joined them to examine the facilities and to sample the food provided by an automatic kitchen tucked in one corner. Citizens and Earth people alike, the assigned ghost informed them, would be able to witness the breakout almost in its entirety. Monitors placed throughout the Thistledown would transmit detailed views of the events and their results. Everyone had a ringside seat if they desired one. No longer hungry or very interested in playing with the quarters, the three women sat before a continuous documentary of what was happening in the asteroid and the precincts. The images were almost too real. After a few minutes, Cunningham turned away from the display and began giggling uncontrollably. This is ridiculous, she said, clutching her cheeks and rolling back on the apparent oriental pattern carpet. It's terrifying. Blakely caught the bug next. We're hysterical, she said, and that sent them both into fresh paroxysms. We don't have any idea what's going on.
Oh, I do,
Hoffman said solemnly, feeling left out.
What?
Cunningham asked, trying to be serious. Hoffman rolled one hand into a near cylinder. She peered through it at them. Blow one end off, the end no one ever tried to drill through, the North Pole.
Jesus, Cunningham said, her giggles gone as quickly as they had started.
What would have happened if we had tried to drill through it? Where would the drillers have ended up? Blow the North Pole off, Hoffman resumed, ignoring the unanswerable question, and knock the stone off the corridor. And after that...
What?
Anne asked, owlish now and also very serious. This half of the city leaves the corridor. We become a space station.
And the stone? Cunningham asked.
Another moon.
And we go back to Earth? Blakely asked.
Hoffman nodded.
Damn, Blakely said. It's a... I don't know what it is. A fairy tale. Maybe it's the day of resurrection. What did they call it? Rapture? Dead people flying up through the freeways? People leaving their cars right through the roofs?
Embarrassed, Blakely turned back to the projected display.
That doesn't make any sense, does it? No freeways, no cars, only angels coming from the sky.
Hoffman made a deep shuddering sigh.
You're right, she said. It's a fairy tale.
Then abruptly she broke into laughter and couldn't stop until her lungs ached and her face was wet with tears. An hour before the scheduled breakout, Corprep Rosengardner picked up a personal message to Hoffman requesting that he be allowed to visit. A few minutes later, he arrived at the apartment door in person. Incarnate, Hoffman reminded herself. She invited him in. By that time, they had all regained some semblance of control. Gardner's political work on behalf of the divided Hexamon and the Naderites was no longer necessary, he explained. He had volunteered to act as corp rep in the new Nexus for the Earth people, and chose Hoffman as the most logical person to speak with. He offered to keep her informed by linking her with his private memory and information service. Her vacation was over, she thought, not without some regrets. She was on call again. I also bring news, he said, standing before her with his hands behind his back. She was beginning to get a sense of the orthodox Naderites, dedicated, almost chivalric, not unlike some of the political conservatives she had dealt with on Earth. We have word of Patricia Luisa Vasquez and the four who were sent to find her.
Yes?
Three of the four have returned to our precincts. They are Lawrence Heineman, Karen Farley, and Lenore Carrollson. They were kept as captives for a time, I am ashamed to say, by the Geshels in Axis Nader and Central City. They were released just before the Geshel precincts began acceleration. They will join your people shortly.
And the others?
Patricia Luisa Vasquez was given an opportunity to find her way home, Sir Gardner continued. What that means precisely, I am not sure. The details are sketchy. She and Gary Lanier were detained and sent with the gate opener and his party to 1.3X9. Many in that party, including Lanier, are now on their way back and have passed through the accelerating precincts safely. They will not return to our sector in time to join with us, however. She had no idea what a gate opener was and didn't feel it was appropriate to ask. She could look it up later.
Are they going to leave the corridor?
I do not know, Gardner said. Their leader, Ser Olmi, has been informed of the timetable. He believes they can escape the sealing of the way. They have been delayed by stopping at several reopened gates to drop off non-human clients. Hoffman absorbed the news quietly, slapping her left hand lightly against her thigh. She had assumed the four searchers and Vasquez had died or been irretrievably lost in the shuffle. For the time being, she had managed to forget about them. Now she once again had something to worry about, with little knowledge of the perils involved or their chances for success. Our 0 hour will be in 43 minutes, Corporate Gardner said. By the way, I thought I would inform you that numbers of Hexamon citizens have been solicited by a small group of your people. There is a wild party going on in the quarters of Axis Thoreau. Some of your female personnel are bartering sexual favors. For what commodities, I don't know. I have placed that party off limits to my people. Hoffman looked at him, startled, not sure how to respond.
That's wise, she finally managed. I don't know who would corrupt whom the most.
In the stone. From end to end of the seven chambers, darkness and quiet. In the first chamber, clouds had built up since the re-rotation. Rain threatened in the darkness. In the boreholes, the absolute silence of vacuum, and no activity but the occasional flight of a tiny monitor. In the second chamber, a faint whistle of wind as the atmosphere regained its equilibrium. More windows had broken out, and some buildings, including a mega, had collapsed despite the efforts of the engineers. In the third chamber, much the same, though no buildings had collapsed. The scattered glows of still active Illusart windows in Thistledown City resembled a swarm of fireflies. In the fourth chamber, the washed-out forests and unleashed waters had finally made their peace with each other. The compounds formerly occupied by Eastern and Western Bloc personnel had been washed away, their debris carried down to the lakes or jammed up against trees near the shorelines. Those who had died to invade or defend the stone, the potato, the thistledown, still lay in their graves, unseeing, their patterns flown, personalities vanished, mysteries made even more mysterious. The fifth chamber, as dark and hollow as a vast cavern in the earth, with only the eternal sound of waterfalls and rivers. The sixth chamber, vigilant, the only chamber besides the seventh still illuminated by a plasma tube, although that was uncertain and unreliable. The plasma tube flickered and was extinguished. No matter. All the preparations had been made, and now only monitors patrolled the Thistledown's vastness. The seventh chamber. A wind blew gently down from the cap, rustling the copses of scrub forest. It lazed through the abandoned tent with a faint whistle, flapping the canvas. A section of the tent sagged where a pole had drifted loose during the derotation. Surprisingly little else had been disturbed. The detonators waited patiently beside their charges. The joined precincts of Axes Thoreau and Euclid were too far down the way to be visible from this point without the aid of a high-powered telescope. The way seemed empty, infinite, eternal and serene, the greatest thing ever created by human beings. Outside the Thistledown, black space and stars and moon, and poor, battered, burned, winter-besieged Earth, where few, if any, were even thinking of the asteroid or the possibility of rescue. How could there be rescue from such total misery and death? History had passed them by. The asteroid's overhauled Beckman drive engines prepared for their part in the drama, stockpiling reaction mass to be slung out and dematerialized in the combined beams. They would reduce the kick of the separation, and the combined kick and counterthrust would maneuver the Thistledown into a circular orbit around the Earth at an altitude of some 10,000 kilometers. The precincts of Axes Thoreau and Euclid began their acceleration in an apparent suicide run to smash themselves against the seventh chamber cap. Within, 29 million human beings, corporeal and otherwise, did the various things humans do while waiting to see if they will live or die. Behind the precincts, 500,000 kilometers down the way, a tiny defense flaw ship was decelerating drastically, the flaw ahead of it brightening to violet and blue. It had to slow to Earth orbital velocity by the time it followed the linked precincts out the end of the way, if it managed that feat at all. The charges buried in the walls of the seventh chamber synchronized. The grips of Axes Thoreau and Euclid were withdrawn, and the huge cylinders coasted south toward the seventh chamber cap at just a little over 40,000 kilometers per hour, or 11 kilometers per second. The detonators reached their appointed microsecond. Within the seventh chamber, there was a noise beyond human description. Billions of tons of rock and metal rushed in toward the axis from the seven charge points, and immense fissures shot outward to the vacuum of space. Around the northern pole of the asteroid, dust and debris spread out in a wide circular fan, followed by a white glow more brilliant than the sun. The glow faded to red and purple. A 70-kilometer-wide monk's cap of rock was propelled away from the asteroid. The asteroid withdrew much more slowly from its severed end, and for the briefest moment between them, there was a hole in space, filled with the light of the plasma tube, showing an infinite perspective, out of which flew the linked precincts of Axes Euclid and Thoreau, barely missing the asteroid itself, shunting aside debris with conical traction fields. Through the fading glow and spinning chunks of rock and metal, the precincts passed out of range of the Thistledown's Beckman drives. The drives then fired to maneuver the Thistledown into orbit. The Way was now an independent entity. The hole in space began to heal, wrapped in a thousand varieties of darkness, violet and sea green, carmine and indigo, venting winds mightier than a thousand hurricanes into the vacuum. Closing. Sealing itself off forever from this universe. Olmi sat back and closed his eyes. Yates was more animated, rubbing his hands together. Senator Oyu appeared as cool as ever, but Lanier noticed her eye movements were frequent and jerky. If Prescient Oyu was even slightly nervous, and Olmi resigned, then Lanier figured he had every right to be terrified. "Are we going to make it?" he asked. "Just barely," Olmi said, eyes still shut. Lanier faced the bow. The brightness of the 7 coordinated blasts had reduced the bow to opacity. Now it cleared and gave them a view of the Way's beginning. Within a glowing circle of molten asteroidal debris and frozen streaks of rushing water vapor was a circle of blackness. The circle was shrinking, being taken over by an iridescent nullity that hurt the eyes, the new terminus of the Way. And then, within the diminishing black circle, Lanier saw a dull white crescent. He blinked. The moon! The floor ship twirled in the outrushing atmosphere. The iridescent nullity had almost completed its task. It seemed to take them forever to approach the rapidly shrinking blackness and crescent moon. Chunks of soil rose from the walls and shimmied up the fresh nacreous boundary. The boundary eclipsed the moon. "Oh, God!" Lanier said. He clasped his hands and closed his eyes. Epilogue. 4 Beginnings. 1. 6 P.D. And all the king's horses and all the king's men. The phrase occurred to Heinemann often as he piloted a blunt arrowhead flyer from point to devastated point around the globe. What the death itself had not incinerated or poisoned, the long winter had ravaged. It had seemed for a time that even the ingenuity, technology, and power of the new Hexamon itself could not make the situation right. Yet, as Lenore, his wife of 4 years, reminded him during his worst, most discouraged moments, "They managed to climb back up even without our help. Our presence has to make things move faster." But even hope and the prospects of a brighter future could not take the edge off, or reduced the bitter gall of what he saw in the course of a single day's surveying. India, Africa, Australia, and New Zealand, and much of South America had emerged from the death with minor damage. North America, Russia, and Europe had been practically sterilized. China had lost a quarter of its population in the nuclear exchange. Another 2/3 had died of starvation during the long winter, which was subsiding only now with help from the orbiting precinct. Southeast Asia had crumbled into anarchy and revolution and genocide. The destruction there was almost as complete. Ashes, barren plains, snow-covered valleys and hills soon to become glaciers, scudding gray, snow-thick clouds casting black shadows over fallow earth, continents given over to bacteria and cockroaches and ants, and among these new ecologies, a few scattered animals who had once called themselves human beings, who had once lived in comfortable houses and known the basics of electrical wiring and taken newspapers and subscribed to provincial points of view about reality, who had once had time for the luxury of thought. It was heartbreaking. Heinemann came to think of his kind, the engineers and scientists and technicians of the earth, as the very tools of Satan himself. His latent Christianity returned with a vengeance. He knew he severely tried Lenore's patience, but from his meandering visions of apocalypse and angels and resurrection, he could at least take some solace, find meaning, and search for destiny and God's plan. If he had once been an agent of Satan, now, without switching occupations, he was an agent of the angels, of those who would transform Earth into paradise. Lenore tried again and again to point out that engineers were as much responsible for saving the Earth as for destroying it. Without the orbital platforms and the whole paraphernalia of space-based defense, the Earth would have been wiped utterly clean of life. The NATO and Soviet platforms managed to destroy some 40% of all missiles. Not enough. Not enough. And how many children, how many animals, how many innocent and... But Lenore would counter, no one born with a mouth and a need is innocent. She was often right, of course. The masters he served now were not perfect, hardly angelic. They were intelligent, powerful, reasonable. Their leaders lacked the ignorant, erratic blindness of Earth's leaders. But they still differed with each other, sometimes strongly. So Heinemann, with his wife, flew the skies of Earth and charted the damage, and hoped for a day when grasses would grow and flowers bloom, when snows would recede and the air would be clear of radioactivity. He worked hard for that day. And he was faithful to his new masters, for he was born again in more ways than one. On his first day back on Earth, he had suffered a fatal heart attack. Larry Heinemann was on his second body. Lenore assured him it was better than his first. He had his doubts, but it certainly felt better. New Zealand dusk, with another spectacular sunset in the offing. Overhead, the large beacon of the Thistledown rose clear and unobscured, and not far away, the speeding point of the orbiting precincts crossed the sky in the opposite direction. Gary Lanier emerged from the Talcid tent and saw Karen Lanier speaking with a group of farmers at the camp fence. The farmers had brought their children to the camp 2 weeks before for Talcid cleansing. They, at least, would not give birth to monsters or suffer the long-term effects of radiation poisoning. But for the adults, there was still much suspicion and distrust. The early rumors of alien invasions and hordes of sky-traveling devils had seemed peculiarly convincing in the aftermath of the world's end. Karen's obvious pregnancy, 6 months along, did much to reassure them they were dealing with real human beings. Lanier still had not told their story to any earthbound survivors. Who could absorb such an incredible and complicated tale when one's thoughts were on simple survival and the health of one's children, or sheep, or townspeople? He stood with his hands in his overalls pockets and watched Karen talking quietly with the shepherds. They had lived and worked together since returning to Earth and had married 2 years ago. Their life was busy, and they were good for each other. But he was not yet content. Not yet free of the manifold neuroses he had picked up in the past decade. At least he could feel the edges of his mental wounds puckering and healing, scarring up, perhaps even smoothing away. Lanier only took physical Talcid sessions to cleanse his body. They were required at least every 6 months to prevent ill effects from the atmospheric radiation. He did not indulge in mental Talcid, whatever Olmi's urging. He was, after all, a rugged individualist, and he would rather accomplish those things on his own. In a few months, he and Karen, if they could be spared from their labor here, would join Hoffman and Olmi and perhaps even Larry and Lenore. They would reload their temporary implants with new training, new data, and work with Earth's corp rep, Rosen Gardner, and Earth's senator, Precian Oyu, to coordinate the massive task of cleansing the atmosphere and reorganizing the survivors. Paradoxically, the Naderites would soon have to deal with the infant cries of their own creed, which was rapidly gaining power in areas not yet touched by the reconstruction. Lanier did not often think of the way now, or of what had happened years past. His mind was too occupied with more immediate concerns. But every now and then he would shut his eyes for a moment and open them again. He would turn to Karen and meet her sunny smile and run his hand through her yellow hair. No sense worrying about those who were farther away than the souls of the dead. 2. Journey Year 1181. Olmi stood in the Axis Euclid public observation chamber, hands folded behind his back, waiting for Kozhinovsky. Together they would try to convince Earth's chief advocate, Ram Kikura, that the legal rights of the survivors on Earth could not supersede the new Hexamon's duty to eventually force them to undergo Talsit purging. He gathered his arguments in his head. If they were not purged mentally as well as physically, the condition of their thinking would be such that strife and discord would tear the Earth apart again, in centuries, if not sooner. They had to be mentally healthy to face the future the new Hexamon was already structuring for them. There was no room for the kind of archaic, sick thinking that had led to the death in the first place. Olmi was not sure he could convince Ram Kikura, however. She had been rereading the Federalist Papers and consulting ancient constitutional law cases. Korzhanovsky arrived, late as usual, and together they spent a few minutes watching the passage of continents, seas, and clouds below. The horizon was still orange and gray with dust and ash in the stratosphere. Where clouds parted, much of the land was covered with snow. "Is your woman going to give us a hard time today?" the engineer asked. "No doubt," Olmi said. Korzhanovsky smiled. "I have a confession. Another young woman has been giving me difficulties lately. Oh, I realize we should all be concentrating on the reconstruction, but I think you'll understand why my mind wanders." Olmi nodded. "She probably did not succeed," Korzhanovsky said.
"At going home?"
"It's very unlikely. I've been thinking about Wei theory. Part of me keeps pursuing those problems. We understood the geometry stacks so little. When Patricia expressed her theories, they seemed right at the time, and they very nearly were, but not right enough to take her home."
"So where is she now?"
"That I cannot say." Korzhanovsky held one hand to the side of his head. "This persistence, though, this pressure to keep working on the problems, I can't say I object. The theory is fascinating. Thinking about it is one of the most enjoyable things I can do. And perhaps someday we can try again."
"From Earth?" Olmi asked.
"We still have the sixth chamber," Korzhanovsky said. "It wouldn't be nearly as difficult as it was before. And we could do it better." Olmi didn't reply for some moments.
"It may be inevitable," he conceded. "But let's not mention it to the Nexus right away."
"Of course," Korzhanovsky said. "After all this time, I am very patient." The engineer's intense, sharp gaze, like that of a cat waiting to pounce, made the hair on Olmi's neck tingle. He hadn't experienced such an atavistic response in years. "Let's go fight the good fight with your advocate," Korzhanovsky suggested. They turned away from the view of Earth and took an elevator to the Nexus antechambers, where Suli Ram Kikura waited. 3. Pavel Mirsky, personal record. "If I am not too far off, or the distorting effects of our journey are not too difficult to calculate, then today is my 32nd birthday. I have settled into life in the central city, taking part in the rituals and exchanges of the Geshul life. I update my personality copies each week and make the acquaintance of dozens of citizens every day, many anxious to converse with me. And I work. I study history. Those who assign work here believe that my perceptions and abilities make me a unique lens through which to view and interpret the past. Rodzinski helps. He has adapted far more completely than I, and even plans in his next incarnation to take on a custom neomorph body. I often meet with Joseph Rimskaya, but he is still morose and not very stimulating. I believe he is homesick and perhaps should not have defected. He plans to undergo Talsit therapy soon, though he has said that before. Beryl Wallace, the other American, we seldom see. She has been assigned to an observation party, a unique and sought-after job, in which I believe she must be serving more as a mascot than anything else, but I could be wrong. The implants can perform wonders. I was never an intellectual. Philosophy bored me. Questions of ultimate meaning and reality seemed pointless. I did not have the capacity for far stretches of the imagination. With the implants, all that has changed. I have taken a dozen more steps on the road to being a different person. We have voyaged a considerable distance since achieving near light speed. I do not believe anyone expected what is happening now. The way is so complicated, even those who created it could not predict all of its possibilities. We now journey down a ghost way, its local nature altered by the violence of our near light speed passage. It has no diameter or boundaries as such. Objects with mass simply cannot exist beyond a distance of more than 20,000 kilometers from the course on which we ride. The flaw, or singularity, vanished 3 months ago, simply evaporated in a pulse of newly created particles, some of them unknown even to the Geshels. We have traveled beyond the domain of the superset of external universes which encompassed all our various world lines. Even were we to stop now and open gates to the outside, whatever that may be, we would encounter realms without matter, perhaps without form or order. It is highly doubtful we would find anything familiar. There are an infinite number of alternatives to the way, each originating in an alternative world line, yet reaching beyond that world line. Until now, way researchers have not known quite how the alternate ways were stacked or arranged, or indeed whether they could even be considered real. Since the way intersects a large group of alternate world lines, perhaps all, could there be more than one way? But by traveling close to the light speed within the way, we have answered these questions and found new ones to ask. We have distorted way geometry in more than the requisite four dimensions. We have also contracted the fifth dimension, drawing the alternate ways together. The way boundaries have become transparent in a wide variety of frequencies, and we can perceive the shape of other ways. We can select which way we wish to inspect, using devices similar to the gate-opening clavicles. It is in observing these alternate ways that Beryl Wallace is now occupied. We can even see, and in some instances communicate with, beings in other ways. So, there are an infinite number of world lines, and because of this one human artifact, an infinite number of connections between them. Our researchers devise schemes to allow us to cross over to other ways, other supersets of world lines, but even with implants I have difficulty understanding what they are discussing. This much I do know. There are ways where the beings of thousands of completely different universes hold commerce, exchanging in some cases only information, in other cases actually exchanging different types of space-time. Is it possible to conceive of the potential that would exist between two universes of differing qualities? Would that potential be called energy? Rimskaya, morose as he is, has continued working and has even made some significant contributions to the researches. He believes he has found a definition of information, the potential that exists between all time-like dimensions, time itself and the fifth dimension separating world lines, for instance, and space-like dimensions. Wherever space and time interact, there is information, and where information can be ordered into knowledge, and knowledge can be applied, there is intelligence. Lest anyone reading this journal of a primitive man should think we spend our time mired in abstractions, let me also say that I am discovering the richness available to those who are willing to alter their major characteristics. The variety of emotions available to a reconfigured human mind, thinking thoughts impossible to its ancestors. The emotion of dash asterisk dash, describable only as something between sexual love and the joy of intellection. Making love to a thought? Or ampersand ampersand, the true reverse of pain, not pleasure, but a warning of healing, growth, and change. Or parenthesis caret plus caret close parenthesis, the most complex emotion yet discovered, felt by those who consciously endure the change between mind configurations and experience the broad spectrum of possibilities inherent in thinking and being. I have barely begun to taste the varieties of human love. Personalities are not necessarily isolated here. I can belong to a wide spectrum of personality aggregates and yet still retain my individuality. I lose nothing and gain 1,000 new tastes of human affection. What use is it to try to measure the distances we have traveled? What use is the personality of the old Pavel Mirsky to comprehend them? Soon, I firmly resolve, I will gather up my courage and join with the extended personalities in city memory. And yet, with all this to occupy me, I still mourn. I still weep for the lost part of myself, still feel sad for a land I cannot return to, a land doubly inaccessible now. But the weeping is buried deeply, where even Talcet sessions have difficulty reaching, perhaps lodged in the one area it is illegal to modify, known as mystery. How ironic that in this way I still feel like a Russian, and that so long as any part of me exists, it will be Russian. Because I share the same mystery with the old Pavel Mirsky, I feel continuity. I feel an urge for the stars, yes, but more than that. When I was a child in Kiev, or so a few dim portions of my memory inform me, I once asked my stepfather how long people would live when the workers' paradise was achieved. He was a computer technician, very imaginative, and he said, perhaps as long as they wish, perhaps a billion years. How long is a billion years? I asked him. It is a very long time, he said, an age, an eternity, time enough for all life to rise and all life to end. Some people call it an eon. In geological terms, I learned later, an eon is indeed a billion years. But the Greeks who coined the word were not so specific. They used it as a pointer to eternity, the lifetime of a universe, far more than a billion years. It was also the personification of a god's cycle of time. I have survived the workers' paradise. I have survived the end of my universe, and may survive countless others. Dear stepfather, it looks as if I will outlive the gods themselves, a true eon. So much to learn, and so much change to look forward to. Each day I breathe deeply, count my choices, and realize how lucky we are. If only I can convince Rimskaya, sad man. I am free. 4. Aegyptos, year of Alexandros, 2323. Young Queen Cleopatra the 21st had just spent a long and drowsy 4 hours listening to the complicated testimony of 5 ostracized congressmen from the Oxyrhynchus gnomes Boulé. Their complaints, her most trusted counselor decided, were without merit, so she dismissed them with a stern smile and warned them not to take their complaints outside Aegyptos to any other polity, for they would be exiled from the Alexandrian Oikoumene and forced to wander east or west in the lands of the barbarians, or even worse, in Latium. 3 times a week, Cleopatra received such complaints, selected from thousands of cases by her counselors, well aware they were mostly for show and had been pre-decided. She was not entirely happy with the limitations of royal power imposed by the oikumenical Boulé in the time of her fathers, but it was that or exile, and an exiled 18-year-old queen had few places to go outside the oikumene. How things had changed in the past 500 years. Cleopatra looked forward to her next visitor, however. She had heard many stories about the head priestess and Sophé of the Hypatheion in Rhodos. The woman was legendary, not only for the tale of how she had come to the Oikoumene, but for her accomplishments in the last half century. Yet queen and priestess had never met. The Sophé Patrikia had flown in from Rhodos 2 days before, landing at the Rakhotis airport just west of Alexandria, and then taking up privileged residence in the Museion until an audience could be arranged. In those 2 days, the Sophé had been taken on the virtually mandatory tours of the Pyramidons of Alexandros and the Diadochoi to observe, how tiresome, Cleopatra thought, the gold-wrapped mummies of the founders of the Alexandrian Oikoumene, and then through the surrounding pyramids and tombs of the later successors. It was said that the Sophé had borne the tours well, and some of her observations had been recorded for broadcast to the 85 gnomes of the Oikoumene. Heralds arrived to announce that the Sophé had come to the Lochias promontory and would shortly be at the royal residence. The counselors cleared the court, and Cleopatra was surrounded by her flies, as she called them, her chamberlains and makeup maids, wiping sweat from her brow, powdering her cheeks and nose, arranging her robes around the golden throne. Across the courtyard, standing half in shadow and half in sun, was the phalanx of royal security. When they divided into two lines, one on each side of the portal, Cleopatra would assume her attitude and welcome the Sophé. The lines formed and the heralds went through their wearisome rituals. The date was Sothis IV, old style, Archimedes 27, new style. Cleopatra sat patiently on her throne, made of cedar from the troublesome hierarchy of Judea, sometimes called Nea Phoenicia, sipping sparkling water from Gallia out of a cup manufactured in Metasithia. Thus, in every single day, she tried to utilize goods from the gnomes, polities, and friendly nations all around, knowing that they would feel honored and that their peoples would feel proud for serving the oldest of the old empires, the Alexandrian Oikoumene. It would be well for the Sophé to see Cleopatra fulfilling her duties, for in truth the young queen had little else to do. The Boulé and the Council of Elected Speakers now made the truly important decisions, in the Athenian manner. The great bronze doors of Theotokopoulos swung wide, and the procession began. Cleopatra ignored the rapidly swelling crowd of courtiers and chamberlains and petty politicians. Her eyes went immediately to the Sophé Patricia, entering the chamber supported on the arms of her two sons, themselves middle-aged. The priestess wore a gown of black Jinqing silk, simple and elegant, with a star above one breast and a moon above the other. Her hair was long, still luxuriantly thick and dark. Her face appeared youthful despite her 74 years, her eyes black and square and penetrating. Cleopatra met those eyes with difficulty. They seemed dangerous, too provocative. "Welcome," she said, deliberately eschewing all the ceremony. "Come sit. I am told we have things to discuss." "Oh, yes, we do, my beautiful queen," the Sophé said, stepping away from the arms of her sons and approaching the throne, one hand lifting the long hem of her gown. She was very spry, actually. No doubt she retained her sons in the temple for their own good and not hers. The Oikoumene was not the easiest place to find employment these days. Patricia sat on the pillow-covered chair, a body length below the queen's throne, and lifted her face to Cleopatra, eyes bright with excitement. "I am also told you have brought some of your wonderful instruments to show them to me and reveal their purposes," Cleopatra said. "If I may." "By all means." Patricia gestured, and two Hypatian students carried up a wide, shallow wooden case. Cleopatra recognized the wood, pigeon's eye maple from Nea Carchedon across the broad Atlantic. She wondered how their revolution was coming along. Little news leaked out from the blockaded coastal territories. The priestess ordered the case to be set down on a wide round table of beaten brass chased with silver. "Perhaps your imperial Hypsilates knows my story." Cleopatra nodded and smiled. "That you dropped from the sky, chased by a furious star, and that you were not born on this Gaia." "And that I brought with me," Patricia prompted, for all the world like one of Cleopatra's tutors. The queen didn't mind. She enjoyed tutoring and learning. Indeed, she had spent most of her life in classrooms, learning the qualities and extent of her realm, and the languages as well. "You brought marvelous instruments, for which there are no exact equivalents in our world." "Yes, yes, these stories are well known." "Then I now tell you things known only to myself," Patricia said. She glanced around the court, and then returned her extraordinary gaze to the young queen. Cleopatra understood and nodded. "This will be a private audience. We will adjourn and meet in my chambers." The court was quickly cleared, and Cleopatra unceremoniously dropped her heavy robes and gathered a light cloak of byssos around her shoulders. With only two guards and the Sophé's sons accompanying them, they strolled to the queen's chambers. Trays of quail and crystal goblets of wines from Kos awaited them, and the Sofei ate with the queen, a very rare privilege. When they were done, the sons ate, and Cleopatra and Patrikia made themselves comfortable on pillows in a corner. Chamberlains drew curtains around them for privacy. Then, and only then, did Patrikia open the lid of the wooden case. There, in thick Tyrian purple felt, the felt from Priden and the dye from Judea, rested a silver and glass palm-sized flat object, a second slightly smaller object, and something saddle-shaped with protruding handles. These objects were almost as famous as the cache of General Ptolemaios Soter, especially among scholars and philosophers. Few had ever seen them, not even her mother and father's. Cleopatra regarded them with unabashed curiosity.
"Tell me, please," she said.
"With this," and Patrikia pointed to the smaller flat object, "I can measure the qualities of space and time. Years ago, when I took refuge in the Hypatheon after the death of my husband, the technai there made me new batteries, and these devices function again."
"I must commend them," Cleopatra said.
Patrikia smiled and waved her hand as if it trivial matters. "The philosophy and technos of your world is not so advanced as mine in some respects, though very nearly. But you have wonderful mathematicians, wonderful astronomers. My work has progressed."
"Yes?"
"And," Patrikia lifted the object with handles from the case, "this instrument tells me when others are trying to open passages to our world, this Gaia. It senses their workings, and it tells me."
"Does it have any other purpose?" Cleopatra asked, aware she was already out of her depth.
"No, not now, not here." To her astonishment, the queen realized that the old priestess had tears in her eyes.
"I have never given up my dream," Patrikia said, "and I have never given up my hope. But I am growing old, my imperial Hypsilotes, and my senses are not so keen."
She lifted herself up in her seat and resettled with a deep sigh.
"Still, I am certain now. I have been given the proper signs by this device."
"Signs of what?"
"I do not know why or where, my queen, but a passageway has been opened on our world. This device feels its presence, and so do I. Somewhere on Gaia, my queen. Before I die, I wish to find this passage and see if perhaps there is some slight chance I might fulfill my dream."
"A passage? What do you mean?"
"A gate to the place from which I came. They have reopened my gate, perhaps. Or someone has created an entirely new road to the stars."
Cleopatra was suddenly troubled. The instincts of 120 generations of the Macedonian dynastic succession were not idle in her blood.
"Are those in your world people of peace and goodwill?" she asked.
The priestess's eyes became momentarily distant and cloudy.
"I do not know. Probably they are. But I ask the queen to locate this passage, this gate, with all the means at her disposal."
Cleopatra frowned and bent forward to see the priestess's face from a better perspective. Then she took one of the Sophé's withered hands in hers.
"Would our lands benefit from this passage, this gate?"
"Almost certainly," Patrikia said. "I am a very minor example of the wonders that could lie beyond such an opening." Cleopatra frowned and pondered this for a moment. The Oikoumene was beset with many problems, some of them, her counselors assured her, insurmountable, the problems of an elderly civilization on the wane. She did not believe this, not entirely, but the thought frightened her. Even in an age of airplanes and radio, there had to be other things, other marvels, which would rescue them from their plight.
This is a shortcut to distant territories, places where we might extend our trade and learn new things.
Patricia smiled.
Your understanding is quick, my queen. Then we will search. I will decree that all our allied states and empires will search as well. It may be hidden, very small, the priestess warned. Perhaps only a test gate, as wide across as a man's arm is long. Our searchers will be thorough, Cleopatra said. With your guidance, they will find this gate.
Patricia squinted at her with almost insolent suspicion.
I have long been regarded as a crazy old woman, despite these marvels, she said, resting her hand on the case. Do you believe me? Yes, upon my heritage as a queen of Alexandros' Egypt and the Macedonian dynasty, Cleopatra said. She wanted to believe the priestess. Life in the court had been very dull the past few years, and the queen did indeed exercise some powers, chiefly in matters involving the political spirit and aims of the state. She could fit this quest into those territories nicely. Thank you, Patricia said. My husband never truly believed me. He was a fine man, a farmer of fish, but he worried about me and said I should live this life only and not dream of others. I hate limitations, Cleopatra said vehemently. What will you do if we find this passage? Patricia's eyes widened. I will go home, she said. Finally, however futile it may be, I will go home. Not before you have finished your work for us, I presume. No, that will be my first priority. Good. So be it, then.
Cleopatra called in her counselors, warned them sternly this was an imperial decree not subject to dissension, and issued a command that the search begin.
Thank you, my imperial Hypsilotes, the priestess said as they strolled back to the court.
Cleopatra watched Patricia leave through the Theotokopoulos door on her way back to the Hypatheion until such time as the search would begin. Then the queen closed her eyes and tried to imagine the old woman's home. Where would such a woman have come from? A place of gleaming towers and mighty fortresses, where people might be more like gods or devils than the men and women she knew. Only such a place could have produced this small, intense Sophae.
How strange, Cleopatra murmured, resuming her throne. The heavy robes were wrapped around her shoulders again. She felt a shuddering thrill. How wonderful!
Unless you know where you are, you don't know who you are. Wendell Berry. Acknowledgements. A book as complicated as this one cannot be written alone, and thank God for those willing, even eager, to help. My deepest appreciation to, in no particular order, Rick Sternback, Ralph Cooper, John S. Lewis, Louis A. DeMario, David Brin, Anthony and Tina Chong, Craig Caston, Lieutenant Commander Patrick Garrett, United States Navy, Lieutenant Commander Dale F. Baer, United States Navy retired, the Citizens Advisory Council on National Space Policy, and of course, Astrid. Errors and misconceptions no doubt remain, and are my own. End of Eon.